I'm not interested in productivity. I'm interested in effectiveness. Are we effectively serving our customer? That means we're working on the right thing and we're getting the right thing done and in the user's hands. We don't often realize that who's important isn't necessarily the user or the company that's using the software. It might be their customer.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Hey everyone, in this conversation, I chat with Woody Zuhl. Woody is a well-known speaker, consultant, and coach, probably best known for popularizing mock programming, which he stumbled upon during his time at Hunter Industries. Now, Woody has given countless talks where he talks about what mock programming is, how the teams that he's worked with have practiced the practice, and so we don't go into those types of details in this conversation. In fact, we'll link to our favorite talks in the show notes so that you can go watch them. Instead, what we talked about is how he creates the conditions that allow teams to work incredibly effectively together. We talk about why he doesn't care much for productivity at all, and what tools and skills he thinks are most useful in a world of evolving AI. The conversation was a ton of fun, so I hope you enjoy. So Woody, most folks who know you because of your work at Hunter and what you've been up to since, sharing information about mod programming or software teaming. I've heard you say in a handful of talks, or reference the quote, I should say at least, that the object isn't to make the art, it's to be in that wonderful state, which makes the art inevitable. And I want to unpack that a little bit because I think it really gets at my perception of your approach. And so what does this quote mean to you?
First of all, that quote's from Robert Henri. So the basic idea is, if you create an environment where great things will happen, then great things have a good chance of happening. If you just try to do the great things, it's going to be really hard to get the great things. This could be thought of the idea of the oblique path. There's a quote from Douglas Adams that I really love that goes something like this. I'll get it wrong. I may not have ended up where I intended to go, but I got to where I needed to be. That's sort of the same idea.
How does that materialize in practice?
I hate to say this, most of what we do in managing is making it hard for people to get their work done. We're trying to make it easy to manage the work, and in so doing, we make it difficult to do the work. So all the things we do that we think makes it easy to manage, we want to keep track of measuring things, we want to make sure that everybody's as busy as possible or fully utilized, we want to make sure that we're not wasting time and things like that, all of this really gets in the way of being effective in our work. We're tampering with the system when we think this way, and the tampering doesn't help. So we need to figure out, how do we make it easy for people to do the best they can do? Or, of course, Deming would have said, people doing the best they can do is not the solution. But I would say to be the best they can be within their space. I think that's worth learning to do, and it is not done by management. It's by liberating the people to be able to do those things.
How do you go about liberating the people? Can you share some specific examples you worked with where this has played out?
We could do a whole week on this. So the first thing is, I believe that the people doing the work can manage that work themselves. And managers tend to want to manage that work, decide who's going to do what, what's the team shape going to be, who's going to be on that team, what meetings will they go to, and so on and so on. The team can figure that stuff out. You don't need to figure that out for them. I had a situation with a company where I was an employee back around 2005, where there was a project that was being done that was really a lot of trouble. It was lots of code, a couple million lines of code. It was used all over the world for managing a certain kind of business. It just was too buggy, and they decided to rewrite it in a more modern language. But while they were doing that, they needed somebody to support the existing code. And I volunteered to do that. Now, I tell this story often, but it essentially comes down to this, and I think I learned it from my father. He said, the worse things are, the easier it is to make them better. I could see this was a terrible situation. Now, they were looking for someone, I think, that they could give this to. And then when things go poorly, they could blame that person. I kind of knew I was being set up, but I also had learned by that time in my life, those are where the opportunities lie. So if you take over something that's failing for people and they just don't want to take the failure themselves, they'll give you a lot of freedom, And so I took it on, as long as I can do it the way I want to do it. And we were assigned a skeleton crew. And actually, nobody was really assigned to this. We just need to find people who are willing to join this team. across the company, five or six people, to get to the point. We sat in our first get together for this. I said, we're going to try and sit together as much as possible. We had our own room where we could be a team. This is before mob programming, the way we know it now, was a well-established thing, but mob programming had already been written about by that time by others. To get to the point, that freedom that we had because they let us do it the way we wanted to, we simply started looking this book from, I hope it's okay to show a book, Mary Popendick, Lean Software Development. I brought the book in. I brought a copy for everybody, and I just put it on the table, and I said, hey, if you get a chance to read this, it's just a grab bag of good ideas. If you can look through it, find a couple good ideas, we'll try them. And we did a value stream map. We worked really closely together. In that book, she talks about all the lean waste, converting them into software development. So how do we liberate the team? They're going to decide how they work themselves. They chose how they would work. We experimented with things, and we would often work three people at one computer, a business analyst, a tester, and a coder. I, as a coder, didn't need to know anything about how is this tested or what's the business logic behind it, because those parts of the brain were sitting there with me. The three parts that were necessary to do this work were sitting together. So that freedom that comes from letting people manage their own work, I think, is a very good thing. As we were doing things, we noticed that things were getting done really quickly. We were eliminating the waste that Mary Popendick talks about. We used a value stream map to find out where the queuing and inventory was, and we got rid of it. So liberating the team, let them do their own thing, let them figure this out. I knew my responsibility. We need to keep this project well supported while they're converting it or writing a new version of it. We knew what we needed to do. Give them the faith and the trust that they can do it.
I think it's a good example of the freedom necessary in order to create the conditions that allow this to happen. You talk a little bit about creating those conditions at Hunter Industries when you joined. Yes. By saying explicitly in the interview process, hey, if I'm going to take on this gig, there are certain constraints that I need to apply to the situation. For example, I need to have freedom to operate and work with this team in the way that we decide makes the most sense without any interference whatsoever. And so you had that privilege as an outsider coming in, being asked to come in and do that. In this other situation, you had the privilege because they were looking for somebody to blame and didn't so much as care, it sounded like, how yep. things worked, as long as somebody else could be the fall person for it. I am curious how that project worked out.
I would say in some ways that was my initial or first what I would consider really big success that people heard about and wanted to know about. So already at that time, I was speaking at user groups about clean code and good practices because I felt these things are important. I want our whole industry to understand the value of these things. And so I was doing my little part for that. But now people heard about what we had done. And essentially, we had a project that had 500 open bugs, and they never could get rid of the bugs. And so we, in really just 3 months, we eliminated all but 17 of those 500 bugs. So that the word of that got around. I started getting invited to speak at user groups and little tiny conferences. Just what did we do? And I essentially made a list, the five things we did and the five things we didn't do. Because, you know, what are you going to talk about in an hour presentation? But one of the things we did was we worked closely together. Another thing we did was the value stream map to figure out where was the bottlenecks, where was the waste, where was the waiting. That's the main thing I was looking for with that, and so on. So, yeah, it was actually a big success. The company actually went from kind of a waterfallish thing into more of an agile after that. So the point is, if you remove the queuing, the waiting that happens in almost any process, where bugs may take 2 or 3 weeks to get fixed, where they're not working on a particular bug constantly for 2 or 3 weeks, but the turnaround time of each bug was an hour or two. With the three of us sitting together, there were two small teams of three people working together here. We didn't even need to prioritize the work. See, this is part of the thing. Managers want to do things like estimate how long it will take to fix this bug. How important is this bug? Is this something we should fix or not? It's like, just take the bugs and get them done. And so the idea here is we were getting 4 bugs a day fixed. On average, we'd sit down, pick the one off, next one off the list. What is it? You know, here's where it is. Can we reproduce it? Yes or no. And on we go. So this is the thing. It's like, yeah, a lot good happened just because we were paying attention to the waste And the team was figuring it out for themselves, not having a manager saying, this is how we're going to get 500 bugs fixed. We didn't know we would get 500 bugs fixed. We just dug in and that's what happened.
What are some of the things that a manager could do to make the work easier that in turn makes it much easier to manage?
So, yeah, this is really important. So in lean terms, you have value-added work and non-value-added work. So if you think of a value stream map, the idea is you have work that actually adds value the customer is interested in and work that maybe needs to get done, maybe not, but the customer doesn't care about. Think of a factory. You have a box of parts over here. Somebody has to pick up that box of parts and move them over next to the machine where they're going to be used. Well, the customer doesn't care. That's not part of what they're buying. That might be part of what your process is in your particular factory, but it's not necessarily a value. So it's non-value added work. So a lot of the work that we do in software development is non-value added work. It's things that the customer doesn't care about. They care that the bug got fixed, that the build that they got works well, and it didn't break something else, because that's very common. Bug fixes usually lead to new bugs being created. So this is not a good thing. I remember reading a study that I think IBM did. 70% of one-line code fixes or one-line changes introduced a bug. If that's true, yeah, we really got to deal with this stuff. But what really is important here, when we try to manage these things, we often separate people by their specialty. We want the database person focused on database work. We want the product expert focused on product stuff. We want the coder focused on coding. And what we end up with is fragmented brains. We really need all the brains on this thing, but we separate them. And that separation often leads to separate departments. So all the database people are in a database department, and the front-end coders are in a front-end department, and the testers, and so on. And those departments need a manager, so we've got a manager. Departments turn into territories. They separate people so they can't interact easily. All of these things that we're doing to make it conceptually easier to manage the work actually makes it harder to manage the work, because the work itself is not getting done well. And then everybody's going, well, we need to manage it better. It's cyclical.
I've heard you say, quote, I don't really care about productivity, which
right.
feels like a somewhat controversial thing to say for someone who's so interested at building
right.
effective teams and helping folks work effectively together. So could you unpack that for me a little bit?
So a question that's often asked, and in the very first talk I ever gave on this, was how can you possibly be productive with five people at one computer? And to me, it was kind of a non-question, because I wasn't sharing how they could become productive. Yeah, I was just sharing what we had done. I was asked, what is this mob programming? First of all, you have to understand the question being asked. And then you have to be able to ask yourself, do I want to answer that question? Is that a question that's meaningful for me to answer? And my first take on that one was, that's not a meaningful question. I don't care about productivity. So the productivity, the way that I use the word, or I was thinking the word was being used, is that we're getting a lot done. So I'm not interested in getting a lot done. I'm interested in getting the right things done. I'm not interested in productivity. I'm interested in effectiveness. Are we effectively serving our customer? And I think that it goes beyond our customer. We don't often realize that who's important isn't necessarily the user or the company that's using the software. It might be their customer. For example, a patient in a hospital is not using the computer. Some doctor or a technician or an assistant or whatever, a nurse, is using the software. But it's to the benefit, or the purpose should be to the benefit of that patient. Same thing with everything. You know, if you are flying in an airplane, you want the software to make that airplane fly well so we get to the other end safely. The software isn't there. The people using it, it's not for them. It's for the people riding in the plane trying to get to their destination. So I'm not interested in productivity. That means we just got a lot done. I'm interested in effectiveness. That means we're working on the right thing and we're getting the right thing done and in the user's hands. My experience tells me maybe someday somebody will do some research on this, that about 95% of the work that goes into any software that we can buy or use is waste, that much of it's never used. There's lots of studies that have been done on that. My own experience has been, we can just do the 4 or 5% that really matters. That's being effective.
How do you figure out what that 4 to 5% is, especially if you're not spending a bunch of time on the prioritization piece?
So the prioritization will not lead us to that. Think of it this way. We need to be able to steer. And the pre-thinking does not give us that ability to steer. It's in the doing of the work that we discover the work that must be done. So it's doing the work, delivering it into real users' hands, and learning what we learn from that process that's really valuable. I don't believe that figuring it out ahead of time is a great path in writing software people are going to find meaningful to them. I think there's better ways, and I think we need to find those better ways. So when we think of steering, that means we need to do little bits and then adjust after that's in the hands of real users. They're using it for the purposes meant to be used, and that's the only really valuable feedback. Nothing else. Now, if we're writing a simple program that does some scientific calculations, that's pretty straightforward. I'm talking about our typical line of business software or almost anything you might use. That's what I'm talking about. The complex projects that people are going to use as a part of their daily work or part of their daily lives. We can't decide ahead of time what they're going to need. I like to tell a kind of story this way. I've got one of these things right here, okay? It's a modern phone. But if the person who first conceptualized a telephone, which probably was along with others, Alexander Graham Bell, but there were a few others, if he had said, this is a great idea, but I can't show pictures of cat on it. I his phone, it kind of just has a big old microphone thing and a thing to hold to your ear or something. It's like, that's not a good phone. And look, it's connected with wires. We got to be able to walk around. Someday we'll have cars and we need to be able to get in the cars and drive with our phone with us. Like, he couldn't conceptualize all that. It took 100 years to get from early phones to modern phones. And who knows what the future will hold. But you get the picture here. We need to be able to steer along the way. We know we've designed a really great platform when people do things with it we never imagined. I thought that was a pretty good quote. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I love the idea. Same kind of a thing here. I don't want to design the project with all those meetings, design everything, because you'll hear people say, yeah, we've got to get it right the first time. Well, what we need to investigate, what makes us think that? Why is that important to us? That's something we better investigate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've talked a whole lot about the different ways that folks can work together and things that you can do to create an environment in which folks can work effectively together. In many circles, the hotter topic is how can people work effectively, not with other people, but in fact with AI. So yeah, Woody, what is your posture towards AI and software development?
As of right now, it feels to me very similar to when I first started learning to program. It's just another tool, another way of doing our work. We're writing instructions for a computer entity to do something. That's very much the same thing that coding was. This is taking it to a different dimension or a different level. I don't believe that it's worthwhile trying to determine if the computer's writing the code or not. And I don't think it is. I can't imagine. It's not doing the thinking. I think that's probably the important thing here. Humans are still doing the thinking, and that may change sometime. I'm not saying I have any answers, but I believe that we need to use whatever tools are available to us, and this is one that's now become easily available. I think when ChatGPT first came out, I messed around with the free version for a while, but I didn't really get that serious about it until about a year and a half ago. I think it's an important thing. I think we need to understand how to use it. It can be used in many different ways, but it's not going to do the work for us.
Well, I think it can do some of the work for us.
Maybe so. But if you sat down and you said, well, what should I do today? It's like getting into a taxi. You don't get in the taxi and say, where should I go today? You know, you're going to a tour guide if that's what you're doing. Somebody's got to guide the thing.
Yeah, I fully agree. And that's an important distinction. How do you imagine software teaming evolving in a world with ever-improving AI systems?
Well, doing the work as a group, I don't think goes away. I think that there are a lot of people who would have worked solo who will now use AI and continue working solo. But most of the work we do requires interaction with other people. And that means if I'm writing software and you're going to use it, that's a kind of interaction. If there's somebody who's going to be talking with you as a user and bringing back all those ideas and putting them into some kind of documents, there's an interaction there. And the other interaction, I'm handed the document and say, read this, and so on and so on. All of those are interactions. Everything that we do in a modern company requires that we interact with others. So we might as well figure out how to get good at it. And the same thing's going to be with AI. I don't believe, my experience with it so far is, it's very much like programming, the way I would have done it, you know, 20 years ago. But what do I know? We've got to be really clear here. Things could change tomorrow. We can't read the future. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, well, as you said, that's not the object. The object is to be able to steer well, because steering well makes doing the art inevitable. And so equipping ourselves to navigate whatever comes up, things that we can't control come up, as effectively as we possibly can. It strikes me, though, and part of the reason I wanted to ask you about this is because it does feel like getting really good at that, the skill of software teaming, of being able to articulate what you want to happen in a way that's easy for somebody else to understand, that practice is in fact the inherent skill that might make someone really, really good at leveraging an LLM. I wanted to get your take on some of this stuff, because as I've spoken to a lot of folks who practice software teaming, my programming, practice pair programming quite a bit, that kind of communication skill seems to be one that is incredibly high leverage in a world where LLMs get better and better. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I think so. We're still at the early stages of this, but absolutely, if we need to work well with others, that could include an AI element to it. And I don't see any reason why we can't be doing all the things that we would have done before AI with a team, that we could keep doing them with a team. The thinking is going to be expanded by having these different perspectives. If our only other's perspective is coming from the AI, then it's going to be very skewed. What makes it think that what is presenting to us as code is better than what we would have conceived ourselves? I think a lot of cases, it's going to depend on what the LLM has been trained on.
If you were offering advice to a software engineer just coming up now, with your wealth of experience in helping teams be effective as possible, helping people be effective working with other people, what advice would you offer, you know, a new software engineer about what skills to master or focus on?
Yes, things are going to change, but I think it's learning the basics of coding itself is worth doing, learning all the same basics that people have been using for the last 15 or 20 years. And that, I think, is much easier to do now with the tools that we have with AI. You can easily try all kinds of things very quickly. I think it's going to accelerate the learning. But that's just one of the skills we need to have. So the skills of communicating with each other on a team are not the easy skills to me that there are, like I've got on my bookshelf here at Knuth's, Art of Computer Programming. If you're not familiar with it, you know, that was like a Bible of algorithms and stuff back in the days. I know in my career, a lot of the stuff I studied in that book, I've never needed to use, because you've got elements in your programming languages that do all that work for you that wasn't done. So a lot of the stuff we need to roll ourselves, as they say. And nowadays, you know, we just use it. We don't need to think much about it. We can read which is most performant and just use it and not worry about, did we make it the most performant, unless we're doing the really bits and bytes kind of programming, which I've never really done. I mean, all I've ever done is line of business kind of stuff.
Well, we are coming up somewhat close on time, Woody. And so I am curious, reflecting on the conversation we had, what's one thing that you hope folks take away from this conversation?
Well, you know, we're responsible for making this a better world. You know, I took this very seriously for myself in 1999 when I started programming for a living, 98, 99. Most of the places I worked, I wouldn't want to work there. In those days, you get a contract. You're there for 3 months or 6 months, and you know it's going to be over soon, so you don't need to worry too much about it. But it was not good, and we've got to take responsibility. It's like, let's make this a better place to work. Let's make the world a better place so that everybody doing the work in an organization is happy with their lives and with the work they're doing, that they're feeling fulfilled, they're getting what they need besides just making a living.
How do you go about doing that?
Personally, we need to be having these conversations. We've all heard of psychological safety. So if we feel we have psychological safety, then we could bring these things up in our work. But many people do not feel safe bringing up these problems. It's like, we've got to listen to these voices. It's the people within the company who have the best knowledge about what's going on. We need to make that safe environment. I read a book recently. It's called Four Stages of Psychological Safety by Timothy Clark. This book from Amy Edmondson, Teaming. This is where I got the word teaming. Yeah, I like using that. That came out, I think, in 2012. She writes a lot about psychological safety. Let's make it safe for people to share their ideas, for people to learn things, for be able to say, hey, I don't know, you know, or I wish I knew more about that, and not be put down for these things. This is a conscious effort that we need to make. And there's a lot of material on this nowadays. But it's something I've been following for quite a while in trying to improve how I bring this forward.
That's a lovely message to end on, so I appreciate you sharing that, Woody. I think the world would certainly be a better place if everybody was attempting to make it so. Hard to argue with that. Well, with that, I just want to say thank you, Woody, for being generous with your time and perspective. It's a pleasure to chat with you here today. If folks want to learn more about you or your work, where should they go?
LinkedIn's the easy thing. So just find me there, connect with me, ask me any questions you want. I'm always happy, and then we can start a conversation. We can always, you know, meet in a video chat or whatever. If you've got something you'd like me to come and work with your company, but we don't necessarily need to do that. I'm always open to doing meetups and those kinds of things too. So just LinkedIn's the easy way to find me.
Good deal. Well, we'll post a link to your LinkedIn in the show notes for folks of ease of reference. Thank you again, Woody. Hope to chat with you again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Jay.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @TupleOnX or visit distributed.fm.